Hey, I'm Daniel Biss.
And I'm Glynis Green.
And we are the co-hosts of Ill-Informed.
Oh, we should have said that together. That would have been cool. We haven't done that yet. Okay, do it. Just Ill-Informed. Just the Ill-Informed.
Hey, I'm Daniel Biss.
And I'm Glynis Green.
And we are the co-hosts of Ill-Informed. A podcast about Illinois state government and politics and what we can do to make it better.
We talked a bit about the process of how legislation gets made, but the work doesn't actually stop there, as you all may know. Today, we're going to spend some time discussing what actually happens after a bill becomes law, because implementation can be a tricky business, with many highs and lows and sharp corners and long, dark hallways. And even the best intentions and best ideas can have unfortunate consequences if they aren't implemented well.
Yeah, exactly. I think we have talked throughout this podcast, and I think a lot of people like to focus on the legislative process. How do you pass a bill? How do you write a bill? How do you persuade legislators to vote a certain way? And then the bill is passed and signed into law, and you feel like, you know, we're done. Our work here is done.
I don't feel that way.
That's good news. It's excellent news. I feel that way. I guess I was a lawmaker, so it's understandable. I was living in my own little bubble. But I think there is a tendency to focus a lot on that
stage
of the process.
Right, I agree. Yeah.
And of course, a law is just a series of words that are, you know, a part of some kind of giant document.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the laws that we talk about and a lot of the issues we talk about are really complex. And the day the law gets passed, all that happens is a giant set of instructions gets put on somebody else's desk. And if you don't watch very closely what that person does with those instructions, essentially all bets are off.
So let's jump right to it then. Generally, who are the major players for implementation for the process?
I mean, it really can vary significantly. You know, the executive branch of government, in the case of Illinois government, is, you know, somewhere on the order of 40, 50,000 people ultimately reporting to the governor with tons of agencies and a big complicated bureaucracy. It might be some of them. It may be a particular unit of local government somewhere. It may be some independent entity. It could affect the judiciary. There's kind of a limitless set of possibilities of who, and there's also a limitless set of possibilities of how, right? Mm-hmm. Is the statement, you know, hey, the policy of Illinois is to do X, we hope you all will do X. Is it person Y must do very specific thing X or else they get punishment Z?
Right.
Is it, hey, here's a broad sketch of a thing we'd like you to do, but you go figure it out for yourself? Or is it, here's an extremely explicit recipe book for what we need you to do. And it varies so much that it can be kind of tricky to track all of it.
So let's kind of tease out the last thing that you said, because I think part of what you were talking about in my mind reads as implementation, and then there's another part that reads as enforcement of a law. So let's talk about the difference. What is the difference between implementation and enforcement?
It's a great point, and I was being sloppy. You're right. So implementation would mean a law gets passed, and then it's someone's job to actually do a thing. You know, like a famous example might be when the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare passed, then that set in motion all this furious activity to ultimately create what was called the Health Insurance Exchange and certain websites, and they sort of famously crashed back in the fall of 2013 and so on and so forth. So that was pure implementation. A law said, hey, go off and do this thing, and then the government agency tried to go off and do that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But enforcement is, you know, the law that we just passed says someone must do X. Then the question is, how do you actually force them to do X? And so, you know, I think an example that we've perhaps beaten in the ground during the course of this podcast, but I think it's an important one, is the minimum wage, where the law now has the minimum wage increasing, but that's words on paper somewhere. And the question then becomes, what happens if an employer is not paying their employees that minimum wage? And this is an interesting point, because the Department of Labor is run by the head of the department, who's appointed by the governor. And what if you had a governor who didn't really believe in paying a lot of attention to enforcing these types of labor laws? Well, that governor could appoint a secretary of the Department of Labor who would, you know, perhaps without being exactly committed to flaunting the law, might not really be all that focused on enforcement. And then maybe over time, employers would get to know, yeah, officially the law says that I'm supposed to pay $15 an hour, but typically the enforcement agency that's going to kind of ding me if I don't do it, they might look the other way if I'm only paying, you know, a dollar less an hour. And so enforcement is typically relatively straightforward, mm-hmm. but to the extent that it's kind of discretionary, that's also super important.
I think that's a great example. So, like, what about automatic voter registration? That's it's a thing that we, the public, want. But
just depends on which public.
let's talk about that. Like, where are we? What's happening in Illinois with AVR as it pertains to AVR?
And I feel like I should back up and say what that means. So the idea of automatic voter registration is, hey, to register to vote, I've got to give a certain collection of information about myself, my address and my birthday and, you know, perhaps an ID depending on the circumstance, mm-hmm. to give a government body all this information about myself, and then they register me to vote, and that entitles me to then go vote on election day. Mm-hmm. The theory of automatic voter registration is, hey, if someone's already giving the government all that information for some other reason,
right,
then why don't we just go ahead and automatically register them to vote unless they ask not to? And the standard example, of course, is driver's licenses.
Exactly, Secretary of State.
When you sign it, when you go to the Secretary of State's office or the DMV and you give your information to get your driver's license, as it turns out, you're usually giving them enough information to also register you to vote.
Right.
So why make a person make an affirmative choice to go somewhere else? Why not just go ahead and automatically register them? So that's the concept of automatic voter registration.
Right.
And so I was involved back in, gosh, I think it was the spring of 2015 in introducing legislation to do this. And there was a long, complicated negotiation, and there's a lot of technical things about implementation on this issue and a lot of different stakeholders and negotiation that went on a long time. And eventually the bill passed. Mm-hmm. And the bill was seen by some Republicans as kind of a partisan Democratic project because, well, frankly, I think there's a tension between Democrats and Republicans about voting, and Democrats mm-hmm. tend to believe that we should make it easier for people to vote, but Republicans tend to believe there's a lot of voter fraud and it's dangerous to make it easier for people mm-hmm. to vote. So there was tension between Democrats and Republicans, and so when the bill passed, Governor Rauner, who was a Republican, vetoed it, and that kicked off another round of negotiation, and then finally, years later, the bill passed with widespread bipartisan support, was signed into law by Governor Rauner, and was supposed to be implemented in time for the 2018 election. So when people, you know, got their driver's license, you know, sometime in the beginning of 2018, that would automatically register them to then vote in November of 2018, mm-hmm. and it just didn't happen. It just did not happen. And the Secretary of State, who, by the way, he's a Democrat, and remember mm-hmm. back when this was a kind of partisan issue, it was Democrats who were for it and Republicans who were against it.
Yeah.
The Democratic Secretary of State, Jesse White, just kind of didn't do it, dragged his feet, and deadlines came and went, and automatic voter registration wasn't happening. And, you know, at the day that we're recording this, it's now spring of 2019, half a year after that election, for which this whole thing was already supposed to be up and running, and automatic voter registration still isn't happening. Not apparently, from what I can tell, because he opposes it, but because it's sort of hard and it's a hassle and he doesn't seem to feel like it, or his staff don't seem to want to do it. And so it just didn't happen. So one thing someone might ask is, you know, why pass a law if it's just words on paper and no one has to do anything? And the answer, by the way, is that there have been groups of people who've been considering, and I think even publicly threatening, to bring a lawsuit. And it's believed that the Secretary of State would quite possibly lose a lawsuit because the law says he's supposed to be doing something and it's simply not happening. Mm-hmm. And maybe that'll be how this will get done, or it seems like there's some progress happening at this moment, so maybe it'll get done anyhow before the next election. But it's an interesting question. You know, the law says he has to. He's not. You know, it's not straightforward mm-hmm. how to force him to. You could go to court and win, and he still could just not do it. And so ultimately, these sort of very pedestrian questions of who's going to literally do which thing in which office on what day become crucial to actually making the thing that was passed happen in the real world.
Is this something that came as a surprise to you? Was it predictable that Jesse White would essentially kind of, we'd be in a situation in which a bill like this would be stalled?
So I personally was surprised, and I think a lot of people were, partially just because, you know, the law is clear, let's just, you know, go follow the law. But I also do think there was a sense in which people felt like, yeah, this eventually passed in a bipartisan way, but Democrats really wanted it. And this guy is a loyal member of the Democratic Party. Right, wouldn't you expect it to happen then? And that reminds me of another kind of strange example of a bill that I worked on a long time to create what was called the Secure Choice Retirement Savings Program. We've talked about it a few times in the podcast. And it was setting up this retirement plan. And that's another one of these implementation things where once you pass the law, someone's got to create a whole program, which is quite complex. And the natural place for that program to live, I think in many people's view, was in the office of the Illinois Treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, Treasurer invests money. It's like a retirement savings investment program. So it sort of made sense to put it there. But when we were trying to pass the bill, the treasurer was a guy by the name of Dan Rutherford, who was a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republican Party was all opposed to this bill. And it was sort of awkward at the time to say, this is a great idea. Let's create a program. It'll help a lot of people. And that guy over there will have to implement it. And then that guy over there who you were pointing at could be like, oh, we can't do that. That's an impossibility. That's,
yeah.
You know, that was a very tough circumstance in which to try to pass a bill. Because how can you create a program that the guy who you're telling to implement it is just telling you is impossible?
Right,
so,
right.
So we kind of invented a sort of a hack, which was to, instead of having the treasurer implement it, we set up a board that was responsible collectively for implementing it. And a majority of the board was appointed by the governor. And the governor at the time was Pat Quinn, a Democrat who believed in the program.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though the treasurer was a part of the board, his skepticism didn't look as bad because a majority of the board was appointed by a guy who believed in the program. And then by coincidence, we passed the bill, you know, within a month of an election where everything flipped, where a Democrat got elected treasurer,
yeah,
replacing the Republican, and a Republican got elected governor replacing the Democrat.
Yeah.
And so we passed this law and then created this board, a majority of whose members were appointed by the Republican governor, and the Republicans didn't think this program made any sense. And so there was a long period of time when the newly elected Democratic treasurer was like, you guys, why didn't you give me the authority to do this? It should have lived here anyhow.
Right.
And now there's a situation where the governor's appointees might, you know, sandbag me. And in fact, there was tension for months and months and months, and the two sides didn't trust each other, and there was a lot of indication that the governor's appointees were trying to sabotage the program. And at some point,
yes,
I, as the guy who had passed the bill, was somehow, I somehow found myself doing this thing that I've only done once in my life, which was perhaps should be called baseball diplomacy. I wound up at a White Sox game with the treasurer and two of these guys who were close to the governor, to like try to talk to these guys for this one interminable baseball game about how we could somehow find it in our hearts to work together and implement this program. And it was just struck me as an utterly absurd thing to do, to
yeah,
tell people to follow the law.
Yeah.
The law was just there on paper.
Right, right.
And there was so much partisan distrust that there was a significant risk that the whole thing would blow up literally before a single piece of implementation work ever got done.
Yikes. So it's so much more about the politics of implementation than anything else.
What I would say is that the politics when you're trying to pass a bill are right up front and everyone can see them, and that's
right,
scary, but at least it's understandable. And then when it comes to the implementation phase, often the politics are just as significant, but they're somewhere behind the scenes, and so it can be harder to work around or mitigate.
So one thing that I feel like is almost necessary for us to talk about when it comes to implementation are the impacts or unintended consequences,
yeah,
of implementation. And one of the things that I think about when I think about unintended consequences and impacts are racial inequities that are exacerbated as a result of these unintended consequences. So how a law is implemented, we know, can add to racial inequities, even with laws with great intentions or things that are really meant to help communities.
Yeah, for sure. And for a lot of different reasons. And one example I always think about is the MAP grant.
Yeah.
MAP is an acronym, stands for Monetary Award Program. It's a pretty significant grant that the state gives out to low-income in-state college students. So if you're—
I was a recipient of a MAP grant years ago.
There you go. Where'd you go with it?
Loyola.
And so that's an actually interesting feature of the program, that it works for both private and public universities.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're a low-income person from Illinois going to college in Illinois, you could be eligible for the MAP grant. And when the program was created a long time ago, the idea was that all of the need would be met, that there would be a pile of money in the budget that would be enough for every eligible person to get the aid they needed to afford tuition. Well, you know, some time passed and that just stopped being the case, you know, as tuition went up and the budget got tougher. And so now the available money in the budget is much, much less than all the available need. And when that happens, there's got to be some rationing mechanism, some mechanism to determine who gets the MAP grants and who doesn't. Because mm-hmm. if you just ask, you know, based on income, there's not enough money to go around based on who's eligible. Mm-hmm. Well, the entity that implements the MAP grant is called the Illinois Student Assistance Commission, or mm-hmm. ISAC. And what they say when you ask them this question is they say, hey, the law that creates the MAP grant doesn't give us instructions. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a rule book for how to decide who among the eligible students gets the inadequate amount of MAP grant money. And so without any instructions, I guess we just got to give it out first come, first serve. Who could argue with that? That's the neutral way to, mm-hmm. to deal with this problem. And so every year they predict how much money they're going to have for the MAP grant, and they accept applications up until they've spent that money, and then they close the door. Mm-hmm. Sounds perfectly reasonable. So let's think now about who's likely to be applying later. Well, here's one category of person who's likely to be applying later: community college students. Yep. Because typically the matriculation and the application process happens quite a bit later. Yep. So now you've got a process that is basically putting the thumb on the scale against community college students.
Right.
Who else? Non-traditional students. If you're a single parent, mm-hmm. you're unlikely to be able to commit to being
early decision. Yeah,
right? And by the way, you might ask when this happens. It happens in like February or March of the year before, right? So you got to commit, yes, I will be in school next fall. By February or March if you want to qualify for this thing. Well, that's you know, something that a lot of high school seniors can do if they're going to four-year colleges. It's not something that a lot of single parents can necessarily do.
Yeah.
And then who else? What if you are a high school senior? Your knowledge about how and when to apply for this thing is likely to be impacted by the number of counselors and the quality of the counseling staff
at
in your school.
Yeah.
And though the MAP grant itself is handed out based on the income of the applicant, that doesn't say anything about the income of the area. So if you happen to live in a wealthy area with well-funded public schools, you're much likely to have a counseling system in your high school that tells you about this opportunity. And so all of these different things basically have created a system that is biased against people living in the deepest poverty, biased against non-traditional students, biased against communities of color. And no one set it up that way on purpose, but it kind of evolved that way. And now that it is that way because of whose voice tends to get heard in Springfield, it's unbelievably hard to change.
Yeah, yeah.
And that to me is an example of how implementation, even without malice, can really, really exacerbate our inequitable system.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful example. I think one of the examples that come to mind for me is SB 100, which is really a bill that is focused on providing alternatives to exclusionary disciplinary practices. So we know, and those of us who've been deeply entrenched in the school-to-prison pipeline work, that there are disciplinary practices in schools across the nation have disproportionate impacts on students of color,
right,
where school administrators and staffs are meting out punishments at very different rates for students of color, right? So if you're a student of color in a district, you're more likely to be expelled or suspended than folks who are not students of color, non-racial minorities.
Or land in the criminal justice system as
absolutely,
well,
which is
for what are fundamentally disciplinary
absolutely, which
issues.
Is the school-to-prison pipeline, yep, at its core. Yep. And so SB 100 was originally written to be a much larger bill. And it really got broken up into three different pieces, which I'll just try to zoom through really quickly. One piece was on data collection and transparency in school discipline. The second one was on creating these substantive standards about how schools can really make decisions around meeting out these exclusionary disciplinary practices. And then then the third one that's not yet passed, but Voices of Youth in Chicago Education or Voice is really pushing this, is to really address the presence of police officers in policing in schools or school resource officers. So one thing that SB 100 did that was really great was really require the state to be able to track disciplinary data and disaggregate by race so that we can identify where the issues are and make some substantive changes. But how that showed up on the implementation side of the house is schools weren't doing a very good job of that. One, they were kind of cheating the data. And what I mean by cheating the data is not really documenting the things that are considered suspensions and expulsions. So I think I gave an example in the Madigan episode of these young folks being kicked out of the classroom and having to being forced to go down to detention or in-school detention and remain there for much of the day without any homework or any follow-up. Those things are not often being tracked or considered as like exclusionary disciplinary practices. And it's just as exclusionary as being out of school if you're sitting in a room all day looking at four walls without any windows, right? And so there's a huge big thing in terms of the implementation side of it. Another big part of it is the state, when these public reports with data come out, much of the data categories are actually redacted. Because of the, you know, FERPA or Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which really protects student records. So you really can't report categories with low sample sizes because of anonymity and confidentiality.
And just to cut in here, FERPA is federal law, right?
Federal
this is something
law.
The state
Absolutely.
Cannot change.
Cannot change.
And
cannot
certainly
change.
An individual school can't even think about changing.
Right. So if, like on a researcher side of things, it's a pretty big thing in terms of ethics. Because if there are low sample sizes in a particular district, you might be able to deduce, you know, who those students are based off of the numbers. So most of the reports or data is rendered unusable to the public and to schools and districts who are actually trying to make decisions for their schools to have better practices. So they're really unable to determine what changes are needed to really move the needle forward. And then I think the third thing was just also something that you just brought up in this last example is really like the state was supposed to be responsible for putting out guidance or a set of rules, promulgate rules for school districts on how to be able to implement this. That was something that didn't get a chance to get done. The only thing that did get a chance to get done was this self-assessment checklist, which was actually put together by a number of organizations that are organizing around this, but it's something that wasn't owned by the state.
So you're saying the state literally just did not do the thing they were told to do in terms of promulgating specific rules that would then go down to the school districts and tell them exactly what to do.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, and there were no enforcement measures in place. Yep. So I think when you think about it, you think about, well, what is the why? I think based
what
on
is
your
the
life,
why?
You might have some different explanations of the why. But from my knowledge, one, the law itself just doesn't identify the key responsibilities that the state was supposed to take in a situation like this. Yes, it was generally understood that these rules would be provided. They weren't. Two, the state really didn't advocate for this piece of legislation, right? And when I say state, we're talking about the Illinois State Board of Education, or ISB. That this is like not, this didn't come out of ISB.
Yeah, and I have thoughts on that I want to share in a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Please do. Because this is just me on the other side of not a legislator. And then the third one is, at the same time this was rolling out, the state was really preparing districts for their ESSA plans, you know, so that Every Student Succeeds Act, which succeeded No Child Left Behind.
Yeah, right. Another piece of federal law. Came down from Washington. Stuff to get implemented.
Exactly. So the resources were really prioritized accordingly. But I am curious to hear your why, because I think that this is another really great example of the ways in which inequities manifest and show up, where there was a lot of organizers and organizations on place to push to make a bill like this happen. But I am curious on your thoughts.
So I do have thoughts about this, and I don't read this as a coincidence, quite frankly. And I don't read it as, oh, wow, the bill, notwithstanding everyone's best intentions, just happens to be really hard to implement. Bummer. You know, and full disclosure, I was engaged in the legislative battles on and off during the course of my time in the legislature. And you mentioned this group called VOICE, mm-hmm. which is an acronym of V-O-Y-C-E, Voices of Youth in Chicago Education. And they're what they sound like. They're Voices of Youth in Chicago Education.
Absolutely.
They're led, from my experience, at least by young people who have been directly impacted by these policies. And they would come to Springfield with some regularity and push on these topics, and they were pretty relentless and pretty persuasive and pretty unsuccessful in getting bills passed for a while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically the bill would come forward and the kind of organizations that represent school districts that tend to be resistant to any additional mandates, right? Don't tell us what to do, state, would show up and say, this is bad. We don't like this. Don't tell us what to do. And then there would also be maybe some law enforcement concern because these would be constraining law enforcement. And so those groups, whether it's the school administrations, something called the School Management Alliance, it's kind of a lobby of school administrators, or whether it's them or the kind of public safety community, they had sort of strong institutional advocates who knew Springfield. And I will tell you, there were several times when by the end of the session, I would be talking to folks from Voice who would be like, we got played. I didn't realize what was happening, but actually someone who I thought was an ally turned out not to be, or someone said something just to placate me, which turned out not to matter. And then, you know, here we are at the end of another session and nothing moved.
Yeah.
And that's not an uncommon outcome for an organization that's passionate and knowledgeable, but doesn't have a lot of clout in the Capitol building. But they were really, really beautifully relentless. And they kept coming back and they kept coming back. And I think those who had been opposed to seeing this move forward started to understand that eventually something was going to pass. And I think here's where the question of what side has more kind of old Springfield hands, more kind of traditional institutional players at the table really matters. Because I think that ultimately when the people who didn't want to see this move forward saw that eventually something was going to move forward, they were able to ensure that it was designed in a way, whether it's because of incompatibility with FERPA or inadequate dollars for implementation or giving a giant rulemaking assignment to the State Board of Education that might then drag its feet. I think the people who didn't want to see this happen understood how to sit at the negotiating table and come to an agreement around something that they knew would be very slow to get implemented or very haphazardly implemented. And that's something that you see quite a lot, that a group of community activists who have enough sophistication and people to begin to move something, but not enough, kind of haven't been around the block enough times to really see the traps inside a particular type of legislative design, might get their bill passed, might get their bill signing, might have their celebration, and then may find out a couple years later, wait a second, our opponents actually might have won in the long run.
Okay, so that's the piece I want to unpack a bit. And it just kind of really grinds my gears.
I would imagine so.
I'm serious because...
For sure.
How then... No, they don't have the legislative chops to kind of navigate through that process. But if we're talking, and a lot of bills are toothless bills, how are activists and organizers and do-gooders for the world able to... understand or discern whether this part of a bill is actually going to have any enforcement upon implementation? Like, what are the telltale signs? Because I feel like based off the conversations we've been having this whole entire season on Ill-Informed, even legislators have a difficult time understanding that.
For sure. I think if you have strong passion and also real mobilization around a complex topic, right? So there's like some complicated thing that you're trying to pass a bill about and you're passionate, you've got a lot of people and you're able to begin to see something move. And you also have no experience with this kind of thing from, you know, your own history. I think you have to either find someone who does. That can be a legislator, it can be a lobbyist, it can be it's just an advocate who's kind of been around the block a lot of times. That's one thing that I think is really critical. And then the other thing is you just need to ask a ton of questions. I think the information gaps that really break public impact on Springfield are the ones where people sort of in the know kind of say, don't worry about it, I got it. Don't ask too many questions, I'll take it from here. And I think it can be socially awkward, but operationally necessary to just not take that for an answer and be like, no, I want all of these questions answered because I'm thinking about how 4 years from now, when a piece of paper shows up on a desk in an office somewhere, I want to think about what the impact of that piece of paper landing on that desk is going to have on ordinary people in my community.
So, but here's the thing. I want to push you and challenge you on that particular piece because I actually think in this particular example, that's not the case. I think that the organizers and the folks who were working with organizers who came to the table were incredibly informed on these things and were really smart about it. I mean, you had lawyers and organizers and researchers and advocates at the table who've been working on this stuff for many, many years. And so I guess for me, how then, even with those very smart, brilliant people on board, might we get to something different from what happened here?
I mean, there's a few different ways to think about this. Part of it is maybe they had no choice but to say yes. Maybe this was the best deal they were going to get, and their options were either say yes to something that will be fundamentally inadequate in the real world, but then live those several years of inadequacy in the real world to have something to go back to the legislature to get more with. Maybe their feeling was, you know, you've got to break this up into pieces and we're going to get another piece done every year and get the legislature more and more used to voting on stuff like this. And I think there is a real risk of double agents, right?
What do you mean by that?
You know, is every legislator who says they're on your side really on your side?
Right.
Or are they just trying to make everybody happy?
Right.
And
right.
I think understanding in a clear way who is willing to walk through a wall of fire with you because they believe in the cause as compared to who wants to make sure everybody's happy, including you and your opponents, that distinction is one that legislators can be extraordinarily good at blurring, even though it sounds like it's kind of, you know, day and night.
Right. So I think the strongest message here from what I'm hearing is the complexity of something really drives the inequity. We just talked about two pieces of legislation that really adds to the racial inequities of the world. And one thing that came up in both of your examples was really the complex nature of both of these things. So I think, would you agree with that? That's fair to say.
I think that's right. I think that in our society in America, inertia drives inequity.
Right.
And complexity creates all sorts of different places where inertia can take hold because you need something to be very simple and very streamlined for inertia not to be a risk.
Right. It's a good place to wrap, honestly.
I
would like,
we said it all. What's left?
What's left to say about implementation? I think, yes, these big issues that we describe can lead to the and further exacerbate the inequities that we're trying to wrestle with and contend with and fix. So, but what are the takeaways here? Just because something passes doesn't mean that things will immediately begin to shift. I think we can agree with that. And,
yes.
and many times it's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
Those are my takeaways. What are your takeaways?
I would say I really, as we were preparing for this, I felt like there were two things that I kept thinking. The first is that when you write a bill or you work with someone who's writing a bill, embedded in that bill are a bunch of both implicit and explicit decisions about how much of the actual work has to get done after the bill's passed, right? There might be like stuff just not mentioned in the bill, which implicitly assign somebody else to figure something out later, or there may be a thing actually written out in detail. There's a lot of the kind of explicit verbiage in the bill winds up assigning tasks to specific people later.
Right.
And those decisions about who gets assigned which task when later are incredibly important, and they can be the difference between successful implementation, good faith failed implementation, and literal sabotage. And I think that as advocates, it's very, very difficult sometimes to predict those distinctions on the front end, but it's super important to try because I think that is one of these places where people with more information can get away with murder if we're not working very hard to hold them to account. That's number one.
Yeah.
And number two, this is more of an electoral comment, execution really matters, mm-hmm. like in everything, right? In yeah. all of life, ideas and values are important, and then acting on them efficaciously is also equally important. And I think that as weird and frustrating and screwed up as our electoral system can kind of seem, I think we do a reasonable job of trying to tease out people's values before we vote for or against them. We ask them, are you for this policy or against this policy? We listen to their life stories. We figure out as best we can if they're with us or against us on issues. Then I think we're much worse at using the election process to figure out who will be successful at actually running the government and causing its functions to be properly executed. You know, we say a few words about experience every now and again. They're sort of buzzwords. But I think, right, you know, as we look at all these people running for president, there's a lot of discussion about who's for Medicare for all and who's for Green New Deal. I'm not sure what we're learning about who's actually going to be well positioned to implement Medicare for all properly should it pass.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wish we were better at asking those questions, and I wish we were better at forcing politicians to effectively answer those questions.
Yeah.
Because if you win on values and lose on execution, you might as well have lost on values.
That's a perfect way to stop this conversation. But I think to your last point, it's a perfect segue into our final episode of the season, accountability.
Mm.
Oh, my goodness. So we'll be taking a deep breath and a long, hard look at all that we've learned over the past 9 episodes. Can't believe it's been 9 episodes. And thinking about how, with all of this knowledge in our big old brains, can we actually hold our government accountable and help the government to be the best government that it can be, or the government that is supposed to be, essentially. Not to get all touchy-feely on y'all or anything, but...
Why not?
Let's assume there's some positivity at the end of this dark and turbulent bureaucratic tunnel.
Yes, let's.
Yes, let's. And with that, bye-bye.
Hi there, this is Casey, co-founder of State Matters and producer of Ill Informed. Thank you so much for listening and taking an interest in learning more about how this wacky stuff works in Springfield and how you can get involved to make the state better. If you support what we do, please consider making a donation at statematters.org. Even $10 makes a difference and also gives that little boost that someone out there is supporting the work we're doing. Again, you can donate at www.statematters.org. And while you're at it, rate and review this podcast to help more folks find us. Thanks.